Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. This is a great group to speak at. In Alcoholics Anonymous today, there are pockets of enthusiasm. There are areas where there's some really exciting, enthusiastic things going on in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is certainly one of them. This is the third time I've been up here. The first time I came up, my friend Dustin B. from St. Paul, Minnesota, spoke here. If anybody remembers him, Dustin the Maniac. And that was fun for me. But I've been here a couple of times, and this is a great group, and I'm grateful to be speaking here and being participating in recovery this way with you all. I definitely am an alcoholic. You know, what does that mean? I'll qualify basically like this. The very first time I ever drank, I felt what was known as the phenomenon of craving, the allergy to alcohol. This is the very first time I ever drank. What happened was a couple of my friends and I cut school. We decided we were going to go back to my house and get drunk. You know, it was a really cool thing to do at that time. You know, we could brag to all our buddies the next day. So I pull a bottle of Four Roses whiskey down out of the closet, and I pour three big water glasses of whiskey. I didn't know how to drink. The only drinking I ever saw, I didn't come from an alcoholic household, the only drinking I saw was on the John Wayne movies. You know, he'd go into the saloon, he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey!" And the bartender would fill up a big water glass and he'd drink it down, he'd grab the bottle and he'd go back and sit at the table and he'd wait until he had to shoot somebody, you know. And that's all I knew about drinking. So I pour these big glasses of warm Four Roses Canadian whiskey. That is not how you drink it, by the way. If you're new or just coming back, I'm not recommending warm Four Roses whiskey out of a big water glass. Here I am, I'm 13 years old, and we start drinking. And let me tell you about what happened to the two guys I was drinking with. They drank about two-thirds of their glass, and they had had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough on you? I mean, how annoying is that? "Oh, no, thanks, I've had enough. I'm starting to feel it." "That's the point! You know, I'm getting a little lightheaded." "We'll go right past lightheaded into fun, will you? Because I want to go to the city." Because that's how I drank. But anyway, these guys had two-thirds of their glass, and they sat back and they watched the show. Okay? Because what I did was I drank my whole glass. You know, I'm looking back, you know so many things only in hindsight. I was alcoholic I was already alcoholic before I started drinking. I got to tell you, I didn't become alcoholic because I drank. I drank because I was alcoholic. There's a big difference there. I was waiting to happen. And as soon as the alcohol went down in my system, I was almost full-blown right then and there. Because I drank, I don't know, more than half of a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. I went into a blackout. You know, that was unnerving. Anybody in here blackout drinkers? You know, you may not have any I nevers. You know, how disconcerting is that thought? Anyway, you ever like lose your car in a blackout? And you got to get people to help you find it? And "Will you help me find my car?" "Well, where'd you leave it?" I can't. "What do you mean you can't remember? Where'd you leave it?" You know, people just don't understand those blackouts. You ever like travel in a blackout? Wake up in Topeka with one shoe or something? You got to pretend you wanted to be there because you don't want to look stupid. I would travel in blackouts. But anyway, I had a blackout. I trashed the house and I had one of those nuclear hangovers. One of those, you know, the first drunken hangover where you just have to remain horizontal for a couple of days. You've learned what projectile vomiting is, and you know, you're just illing, and I was sick for a couple of days. Now, if I would have put anything else in my body besides like alcohol and gotten that sick, I never would have gone near it again. You know, if it would have been a food product or something, you know, I never would have gone near something that made me that sick. But alcohol did something for me. It made me feel larger than life. It got rid of a lot of the self-consciousness I had. You know, it allowed me to finally feel like I belong on this planet. I didn't have, you know, all throughout my early drinking history, I really didn't have a drinking problem. I had a sobriety problem. Sobriety was my problem. Drinking was just a bad solution to my problem. Now think about it. Think about your own drinking. Think about what it was like when you went into the bar or you went into the liquor store. I mean, here's how I would go into the bar. I'd get up to the bar and I'd be looking for the bartender. Bartender, oh, get over here. You know, I want a whiskey. You know, give me two whiskeys. It might take you a while to get back here. You know, back them up with a couple of beers too. Like right now, you know. Hey, what's wrong? I'm sober. That's what's wrong. Hurry up. Well, yeah, I got a problem here. Now, you know, and you'd start drinking, and it would be like, you know? Now, is that a drinking problem or is that a sobriety problem? It's a sobriety problem. I never felt comfortable with myself or my environment. I just didn't. So I used booze and sometimes drugs just to get away from it, just to get away from me. I needed an anti-Chris medication. You know, I needed a vacation from my head. And I would drink and I would use a lot of drugs and you know, whatever I needed to do to just try to just, you know, get okay with being right here, right now with myself. And what happened was, I had that nuclear hangover, and as the course of that week went on, I started to forget more and more how ill I was, and I started to remember more and more what alcohol did for me. Okay, I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd don't know a new freedom and a new happiness when they have a glass of wine, you know? I do. All of a sudden, my fears fall from me, you know? I find that I can really be of help to my friends. I can know a whole lot of stuff about stuff I know nothing about. And I can just be the life of the party, whether I really am or not. At least I think I am. And that's a relief to me. So I started to remember what alcohol did for me, and I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. Now, I was 13, and the drinking age was 21, so that was kind of problematic, you know, strategic difficulties, but nothing I couldn't overcome. So I started to figure out where I was going to buy it, who I was going to drink it with, where we were going to drink it, what was it going to be. It's not going to be Four Roses. You know. And I started to become really, really preoccupied with the alcohol, and it started to take precedence. Now, it just started to take precedence over other important things in my life. Now, I come from a pretty smart family. I have a brother and sister who are both PhD college professors. My mother and father were both Phi Beta Kappa out of Chapel Hill. I mean, we were just burdened with minds, this whole family. And I come along, okay? And I'm doing okay in school. You know, I'm a little bit nervous and high-strung, and, you know, teachers are wondering a little bit about me. But as soon as I start drinking, all of a sudden, you know, I'm like a D-minus student in 10 minutes. Now, I didn't say to myself, you know, wow, I'm becoming preoccupied with alcohol. If I keep on like this, my grades will slip to the point where I may not get into college of my choice. I didn't think that. You know what I thought? Get off my back. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. It's none of your business. Just leave me alone. That's like the war cry of the alcoholic. And that's what I started to do. And I started to, you know, hang out with the people who were causing the trouble. And, you know, this is the early 90s, and I'm sorry, the early 70s when I'm starting to party a little bit in the late 60s. And there was some stuff happening back then. Anybody from that period of time knows. I mean, it was insane. At that point in time, nobody knew what was going on with the drugs. None of the teachers were educated, or the cops didn't know what was going on, and we were just running around crazy, you know. And alcohol was always a part of this. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts before I was 24. I got 3 DUIs before I was 26, and I lost a family before I was 28. I lost about 15 jobs before I was 30. you would think that I would say, hey, wait a minute, you know, something's going on here. No, I mean, it was me and the bottle. It got to the point where I was, you know, it was just me looking at, it's just you and me, you know, looking at the bottle of whiskey. And it's us against the world, you know, they're letting us down, you know, they're marginalizing us. I was out of my mind. I'm going to tell the one story about my last DUI. I'm a guy from Florida. I went to college for 3.5 years and got 6 credits. That's another one of my the high points in my life. You know, one was appreciating swimming or something. I don't know. It was like crazy. But this guy that I was a roommate in Florida came back into town, and I'm full blown alcoholic at this point in time. Okay. And he doesn't really know this. It's really dangerous to take me out drinking, you know, in the last 5 years of my drinking. I'd get you arrested or something. I remember getting in a fight with a guy while he was driving down the highway. He was the driver, you know. That's real smart. Anyway, he comes over and he goes, let's go out drinking. So we go. I get absolutely tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk. You know what I mean? In about 5 minutes. And we show up in this bar. And I remember walking up to the bartender and going, bartender, I got to be honest with you. I wouldn't serve me. And he goes, why? I go, because I'm trashed out of my mind. And he goes, well, for being so honest, well, you have. It's on the house. So I think a second, I go, triple bourbon. Okay? So he pours me out this big triple bourbon, and I start drinking, and I'm looking around, you know, just swaying back and forth. I look around, and I notice that there's a table of 4 lovely young women right over here in the corner who would really benefit from my company, you know? I just know how much they would appreciate it. And I started heading over that way. And I remember I get about halfway there, and they all look, and they're like horrified. They're like, ah, like this. And I make it almost to the table, and I trip, and I fall on their table, knock their drinks into their laps. Just it's an absolute mess. And I remember my friends like carrying me out to the car. You know, later that night on the way home, supposedly I crossed the double yellow. You know how that is. You know these cops. You know, supposedly I crossed the double yellow, and they pull me over, and he knocks on the window. I roll the window down. Yes, officer. And he goes, license, registration, insurance card. So you know, I lean in, and I'm working in the glove compartment trying to get this stuff right. Not, you know, it's like for about 2 or 3 minutes, I'm fumbling. Finally, I just give up, and I grab the entire contents of the glove compartment. I just hand it to the cop. It's like brushes and maps and, you know, packs of tissues and stuff. And they just have no sense of humor. So he takes me up. He takes me up to the police station. Okay. And they start. This is back when they would film you. Has anyone ever been filmed in a DUI? Has anyone ever seen their film? Do not do that. You'll need psychological counseling for a long time after that if you do. But anyway, they decide to film me. And, you know, remember hazy recollections? Like, you don't remember, like, the whole night, but you remember little bits and pieces? Well, I remembered that I nailed the ABCs. Okay? I nailed them. Okay? I remember. So I hire this attorney, and we're going to fight this, you know? And I tell the attorney, I nailed the ABCs. You know? Now, I don't remember much else. Now, I hire this lawyer. He's like $1,500. It's a multiple DUI, so he charges a lot. He's in a 3-piece suit, and we go up to the police station, and the first thing we're going to do is look at this DUI video. Okay? Now, I should have gotten a clue, because as the cop handed my lawyer the VHS tape with me on it, he sniggered. He went like this. That was a tip-off. Because as soon as they put it in, I was like horrified. I was so drunk. Now, it gets to the ABCs, and I nailed the ABCs, all right? I nailed them like this. A! B! Can I have a cigarette? C! It was, you know, I was It's like, oh. And there's parts of this video where they actually have me walking the line, and I'm hanging onto the wall. And they're saying, Mr. Schroeder, please don't hang onto the wall. It was awful. And the whole time, this $1,500 lawyer is, you know, very prim and proper, and he's taking notes and everything. Now, at the end of the video, the cops turn to me and they say, okay, we're about to turn the video off. Do you have anything to add before we do that? And I look at the camera and I go, yeah! Like this, right? I go, oh my God! The lawyer who's been like this finally goes, blah! He's in hysterics. He's got, 30 years I never seen anything like this. Blah! You got any hope at all? I'm like, oh. These things happen to me all the time. Things like this. It was just my life. You know, when I got into AA and they say, you need to depend on a power greater than yourself, I'm thinking of God as like some kind of cosmic Alan Funt. You know what I mean? I'm thinking if there is an omnipotent God, he's having a big joke on me. You know what I mean? Allegedly, he's up there with St. Peter. Let's get Chris, you know, really high on Quaaludes and drive to the police station and ask directions, you know? I mean, just some of the things I was doing was nuts. Now, I walked for like 4 years after that. It was brutal. But I didn't even consider giving up drinking. I mean, we're the type of people who go, you know, it's my fourth DWI. I've got to give up driving, you know? I mean, think about drinking. So I did. I gave up driving for 4 years and drank full time. Now this goes on and on and on. And each of us, I believe, you know what a bottom is? A bottom is simply a place where you just don't wish to go any lower. And you become willing to do things that you're going to find uncomfortable that you may not even completely believe in. But you're grasping for some kind of solution to this problem because you don't want to feel this bad anymore. That's really what a bottom is. And I got to mine, I actually had two, but my last one was Christmas 1989. You know, I was living back with my mother at this point because what happens is when you lose your license and the cops are looking for you and you're not showing up for your community service and the bill collectors are knocking on your door and all your friends are mad at you and you're living in Florida, you start to think if mom needs any help around the house. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what you do. And so I've been living with her for a while. And it's Christmas 1989 and my brother and sister, their nieces, nephews, you know, animals. I mean, the presents are under the tree, and you know, the carols are on the stereo, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. And I start drinking Johnny Walker Black. That's my Christmas drink. Anybody have a Christmas drink in here too? You know, special drink that you break out on Christmas. Well, Johnny Walker Black was mine, and I drink a whole bottle, and I go into an insane rage, drunken blackout rage. And I threaten my entire family, okay, with a handgun. I'm going to kill all of you. You know, I'm going to kill every one of you. Bastards, you bastards, I'm going to kill you. And you know, they weren't looking for that kind of festive atmosphere. So they picked up and they took their Christmas elsewhere. And, you know, I came out of this, like, multi-day blackout, you know, not knowing what the hell happened. And I found all these hard liquor bottles in the sink, you know, vodka bottles, whiskey bottles. There was a pile of them like this. I must have just been drinking like straight for like 5 or 6 days, just pass out, drink. It was ugly. And I started to go into the DTs because I had gotten to a point where I just couldn't. There's a jumping off place that they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't think about continuing drinking. And you can't think about continuing life without drinking. And you're at this place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You're at a place where you're going to either wish for the end or cry out for help or something. Now, the alcoholic, this is an interesting statistic. The alcoholic is 60 times more likely to take their own life than the non-alcoholic. Remember that next time you're filling out a life insurance policy when you got to check that box, by the way, because the actuators know that. But anyway, I got to a point where I remember crying out to my Alan Funt-esque type of a God, you know, either kill me or let me get sober. I can't live like this anymore. My life had slowly deteriorated to the point where, I mean, if I can get crazy enough to like threaten to kill my family, that's a problem. You know, I have a little bit of fondness for them. I don't want to wake up and, you know, they're all dead and I'm in prison. That would be really inconvenient. So, this had my attention. And I remember crying out to God. And I remember going through the DTs, which are fun. Anybody in here ever go through the full-blown DTs? You got animals running around and, you know, there's things like, there's maggots crawling on the slip covers and a big demon came out of the ceiling to eat my face. That was special. You know what I mean? Okay, it was like, I was freaking out. And I got to a point where, you know, I'd had some exposure with AA and, you know, I didn't really like it very much, but I had some exposure with AA and I'd even done a 28-day program. I'd even done aftercare. I'd even sat in group. Anybody ever sit in group? Isn't that fun? They put you in a circle and you talk about your day. Well, my day really sucked. Let me tell you about all the assholes in my life. You know? And then somebody go, oh, you think you've got assholes in your life. Let me tell you about my... And I'm thinking the whole time, will you shut up? Just shut up. I want to share. You know? You're taking my time. You know? Where the hell did that come from? Group. You know, trying to treat alcoholism with group is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? And I had done that, you know, and it even made me more pissed off. And so I've been exposed to all these different things. And I decided, you know, this, I'm going back to AA. And I had a car at this time. This particular car was a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls. All the quarter panels were busted. Okay, no heater, no clutch, no emergency brake, no heater core. So if you turned on the heat, it would squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. And it had orange. Somebody had taken a gallon of orange paint and splashed it all around the interior. I mean, this was a $100 Quaalude car. You know? I would buy these things really cheap because I'm always wrecking them. And every once in a while, I'd run into like a late model BMW, and the first thing I'd say is, what's the matter with you buying such an expensive car? Are you out of your mind? I can just junk mine, no big problem. Now there's all this insurance we got to worry about. And they would never like follow my line of reasoning. They'd never really feel the same way I did. But anyway, you know, here I am. Just finishing up my detox, and I'm desperate. I have a willingness that's just born of absolute desperation. I didn't have the guts to kill myself, but I just knew I couldn't. If I put another drink in my body, I was going to die. You go through one of those DTs, and you just know that you're on borrowed time. And so I knew I would have to separate from alcohol somehow. I thought maybe if I go back to AA, I might stand a chance. So I had to find a flat meeting in the meeting book because I had no clutch. So I look in the meeting book, you know, I find out there's a flat meeting in Morristown, you know. So I go to this meeting in Morristown and I pull in and I sit down. And you got to understand, I'm like shattered. I haven't slept in 4 or 5 days. I've just been going through the DTs. But I'm there, you know, and I'm like this and somebody hands me a step book. Here's a step book. We're on step 12. And I'm looking around, like, I look down the row, and everyone's reading a paragraph out of the 12th step, and they're coming at me. Okay? They're like three people away. So I go, I gotta get out of here, right? So I left, and I'm standing out having a cigarette on the stoop, thinking, you know, this AA stuff is just way too much. I don't think I can do this. And this guy comes out and reaches out to me, and he goes, hey, what's your name? It's your Chris. He goes, well, what's your deal? I was drinking as hard as a big demon. He goes, well, well, why don't you come on back into the meeting? And I'm like, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night, you know, I'm going to go to this thing tomorrow night. And he's like, no, come on back in, because he was smart enough to know what tomorrow meant. You know what tomorrow means for an alcoholic? Tomorrow means never. So he drags me in, and I don't want to make a scene. And we sit out in the second row, and now they're finally done reading, and they're sharing. And somebody's sharing about, you know, what it would be like if maybe one day they actually did the 12-step, you know. Here's my opinion on it for 10 minutes. You know, somebody's sharing something, you know. And I'm like, shot out. And now the guy leans over to me and says, now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. I'm like, oh, there's a meeting tomorrow, and everybody raises their hand. Everybody's coming back. I'll do that tomorrow. He's like, raise your hand and tell everybody. He's starting to get loud now, and people are starting to look at me. You know? And you know what happens when they start to look at you? They're going to be thinking at you soon. You know? And I wanted no part of that. So finally, he's getting so loud that I've never seen this done before. I've never seen it done after. But right in the middle of somebody sharing, I raise my hand. You know, this woman sharing some crap, you know, and I raise my hand. And the person leading the meeting, like, looks a little confused, but sees there's something going on. So shuts the person up and calls on me. It was great. I remember saying something really profound like this. Oh, it's because of the alcohol. It's relapses. It's horrible. It's Jesus. It's diabetes. Look at that. It's horrible. Puking. I was terrible. Thank you. And there's dead quiet. And then all of a sudden, yeah, everybody starts cheering for me, okay? And, you know, it was the most amazing thing. And, you know, I took it as acceptance at that point in time. You know, I've since learned that basically what it is, yeah, you pathetic bastard, oh my God! I thought I had troubles, oh, I came in here thinking I had troubles, and I see you, oh, I feel so much better than that! You know, so I'm sitting there, you know, like this, Here's what happened. By me raising my hand, I mean, there was a wall of self-centered fear. You got to understand, alcoholism is built on a foundation of selfishness and self-centeredness. Being self-centered. It's all about me. They're going to be thinking at me. They're looking at me. You know, oh! I mean, that's what alcoholism is. That's why we drink, to try to overcome that feeling of self and apartness. And by raising my hand a little bit, I was able to knock back a little bit of the fear that was keeping me from being able to come in and do Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just too self-conscious. I had too much anxiety to be able to do Alcoholics Anonymous. And by this guy making me raise my hand, I knocked down just a little bit of the fear so that I started to think that maybe I can survive this thing. Now, this is 1989 in North Jersey. I only went to meetings kind of close around my house, so if I'm describing AA that really wasn't what you've experienced, understand that, you know, I just was around my area. And what was around my area in 89 was something that had, Alcoholics Anonymous had deteriorated to such a degree in the area that I was in that it basically was bad $1 group therapy. That's what you could expect when you went to AA meetings. You could expect everybody to just vomit out all their problems and say thank you, and then everybody holds hands and says the Lord's Prayer and goes home. That's really what Alcoholics Anonymous had become in my area. Now, if you look at the origins of AA, if you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you study the way the earlier members practiced recovery and practiced carrying the message, what I was experiencing in 1989 and 1990 would have been unrecognizable to them as Alcoholics Anonymous. In the beginning, what AA was it was a program of 12 steps that had a support fellowship. The fellowship was all about supporting you, going through the steps and then working with others. That's all it was about. It was not, let's dump our problems and walk away with only half of them or whatever. It was all about fitting ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man and to be able to carry the message to other alcoholics. So it was a program with a support fellowship. Well, what I experienced in 1989 was a fellowship with quite possibly a support recovery program if you could find somebody with experience with it, which was really hard to do. Okay, very few. You would go to step meetings. You would go to step meetings, and you'd always hear this. Well, I haven't done this step formally, but I want to share for at least 10 minutes on it. You know, because I've got some opinions and ideas. You know, I mean, you know, I remember hearing that all the time. You know, well, you know, have you paid the money back? Have you made direct amends? Well, no, but you know, I'm going to share. You know, so there wasn't a lot of people with any real experience in the recovery process. And I didn't know any better. I'm going to these meetings and I am the fellowship guru. Okay, I was desperate. I was going to 12 meetings a week. I was a coffee maker over here. I was a secretary over there. You know, this was District 18, so they had the no-show GSR commitment, and I was that for a while. You know, all of these things. I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting. Anything you asked me to do, go out to the diner, you know, whatever you want me to do, I'm there. And it's all this fellowship stuff, and I'm active. And I'm still a complete mess. That self-centered nature that's inside me, the being anxious, being self-conscious, being uncomfortable. I don't really want to be here, you know, or you know, my boss is an asshole, you know. I mean, I had all these personal relationship problems. I had money problems. I had, you know, I had emotional. I couldn't control my emotional nature. If I was depressed, I was really depressed. If I was mad, I'd kill you, you know, or I'd hide, or you know. I mean, I was just a mess, and I was going to a gazillion AA meetings. Okay, and this is the spiritual malady that they talk about in the early part of the book: restless, irritable, discontent, filled with fear, guilt, remorse, shame, anxiety. All these emotions all over me. I was not in control of them, and they were running my life. I was absolutely miserable. But I'd been miserable like that for so long, I just didn't know that you could be unmiserable. I mean, it was status quo for me. So I'm going to all these meetings, and you'd go, well, hey, Chris, how you doing? And I'd give you the pat answer. Great. Real good. You know, if I was honest with them, I would say something like, well, you know, I'm thinking about suicide, and I'm going to take a bunch of you out before I do that, you know. I'm completely out of my mind, you know. How are you? You know, I mean, you can't be honest like that. So I'd say, great, you know, great. Went to a whole bunch of meetings this week, you know. But I'm nuts, okay? Now, and no one in my area had any experience with an Alcoholics Anonymous recovery program. Because AA had devolved into this group therapy animal over the years so long that there just was no recovery left in there. There was sobriety. Don't drink. Go to meetings. They pat you on the head. It was like AA was a big pep rally. You know, yay, yay, we don't drink today, you know. Or it was like a football huddle. Okay, you know, we're going to keep it simple. First things first, we'll meet back here tomorrow. Okay, break, you know. And I'm like out of my mind, okay. Now, I'm homicidal, and I've got like a year and a half, 12 meetings a week. And what happens is this buddy of mine hands me a set of tapes. They're a set of big book workshop tapes from a couple of guys in Arkansas. Okay, now, I'm thinking, Arkansas? You know what I mean? I'm from New Jersey. Arkansas. Well, you know, I had a long ride to work, so all right, you know. So I start throwing these tapes in, and of course, these guys, Joe and Charlie, in 1978, basically brought Alcoholics Anonymous back out of the ashes and started to say, hey, that guys, we're forgetting the recovery part of this. You know, and I got a hold of these tapes and I started to listen to them. Now, you got to understand, when you get hit with the truth, usually the first thing that happens is you're pissed off at whoever told you. Okay? So all of a sudden, now I really hate people from Arkansas. Okay? Because what they're saying is they're saying, Chris, you're going to meetings like crazy, but you do not have an AA program. If you're not involved in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, actually taking the spiritual exercises as they're laid out in this book, you do not have a recovery program, so don't say you do. And when you go back out, don't tell people that AA didn't work. Because that's what AA is. The 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, if when practiced as a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and allow the user to become happily and usefully whole. Okay? So I'm listening to these guys, and you know, I'm like, I haven't heard any of this in these meetings. What the hell are these guys? What kind of AA do these guys have in Arkansas? You know? And what happened was, I had a sober bottom. Anybody ever get in a barrel? I mean, you're sober a while, and like two or three really bad things happen, and you're just shot. I mean, you're emotionally, you're just in the garbage can. And that's what happened to me. And it got to the point where I had an option. Kill myself, drink, or maybe these guys from Arkansas have got some kind of an answer. So what I did was just another thing, not out of any virtue on my part. The only motivation was not to feel bad anymore. I was tired of feeling bad. You know, we suffer, I swear to God, we suffer like nobody else can possibly imagine the alcohol. We are tortured at certain times by our personality and our emotional nature. So anyway, I pull out the tapes and I start with tape one and I open my big book and I get a pad and a pencil and I'm just waiting for them to give the instructions. And I start actually to go through the book like it says it's the Alcoholics Anonymous textbook. Now what had happened, and I'm only talking about, you know, my little group in North Jersey where I was, what had happened was it had become almost like if you were interested in calculus. Let's say you were interested in calculus and you signed yourself up for calculus and you're going to the calculus class. And you're sitting in the class and you're sharing about calculus and talking with people about calculus, you know what I mean, and, you know, hanging out with the other calculus students, you know, but you don't open the book and do any of the exercises, so you never solve any of the calculus problems. You're just grateful for calculus. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense? You know? Well, that's what everybody was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous in my area. They were going in, they were sitting, and they were talking about sobriety, and they were sharing about the steps, and they were in the step meetings reading about the steps, and nobody was doing them. You know what I mean? And, you know, it would be like if you were really interested in flying, and you would go to the airport and hang out in the terminal and talk about flying. You know, yeah, there's a butte going off there, you know. And, you know, that seats 250 people, you know. Well, are you ever going to get on a plane and fly? Or are you just going to sit in the terminal and talk about flying? Well, I was sitting in AA meetings where people were talking about flying. There was nobody flying. So all of a sudden, I actually go through these steps, and I actually made amends. You know, I actually did a four-column inventory and resumes. I actually started to pray and meditate, and I actually started to try to carry the message to other alcoholics. Now, by doing that, we're offered a bunch of promises in our book, and they started to happen to me. Now, I didn't know what was going on, but all of a sudden, my self-centeredness started to become healed. I started to be okay where I was with who I was with at any particular given time. I did not feel uncomfortable with myself and my environment. I didn't have that self-centered fear or anxiety because I went out and made amends. I didn't have the guilt and remorse anymore because I had made an attempt to turn my will and my life over to care of God. The fear started to leave. And I started to heal emotionally, mentally, psychically, and spiritually. Because that's what these steps are designed to do. They're a recipe for a spiritual awakening. And I kind of stumbled on this just because I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. And I started to heal. And, you know, people started to see the change in me. Now, around this time, I was sponsoring some people who were drinking on me. You ever sponsor people to drink on you? Make you look bad? You know what I mean? Is Harry yours? Do you know he's drinking and he's hitting on the young newcomers? Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him, you know. Well, I had a whole crew of guys that were drinking on me because they were real alcoholics, okay? A real alcoholic is going to drink. And these guys were drinking. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to get them over my house and I'm going to start reading through the big book. And we're going to do what Joe and Charlie did. I'm just going to do it with them. And we're going to read. And, you know, when it says to do something, we're going to stop and do it. You know, and I'm going to see how this goes. And so I started to take people through. I didn't know what I was doing. But I started to take people through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, now, if you really want to learn something, teach it. You know what I mean? If you really want to know something, teach it. And I started to really understand this stuff. And because I would take these exercises with the guys, I started to really get an experience with this recovery process. Now, I got to tell you, this was in the early 90s when I started doing this. Every single person who made it through the steps, in other words, who actually did a full-blown fourth and fifth step, who made amends, you know, finished their amends list, started to pray and meditate, using the 10th step as a reactive way of living, meditating and praying and working with other people. Every single one of the guys that did that, they're still in AA today. They're sober, they're card-carrying AA members in good standing, they're still working with others, and their quality of life is out the roof. Now, this is important. Every single one of them. Now, the people who said, hey, Chris, would you sponsor me? But really didn't mean it, because when it came time to doing this work, they thought it was an overreaction to a problem that they could take care of themselves. They didn't understand the first step. All of those people are gone. So everyone that did it is here. Everyone that didn't is gone. You know, this is from the early 90s. That's a pretty significant thing. If we're suffering from a progressively fatal illness, wouldn't you want to know the recovery process? The thing is that we fight in Alcoholics Anonymous is a lack of enthusiasm to recover. We all have it. We've all got an ego that balks at investigation. We've all got a lack of enthusiasm. I'll give you a for instance. Let's say you're diagnosed with a strange kind of pancreas cancer. And you go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh man, this is really bad. You've got, you know, a month to 6 months to live, and every day it's gonna get worse, and you're gonna go out in disgrace. It's just gonna be horrible. And you go, well, doc, is there anything I can do? And he says, well, you know, in Seattle there's these people that have this 12-stage process. And you know, the strange thing is everybody that's made it through all 12 of those stages has recovered from this type of cancer. What wouldn't you do to get to Seattle? You'd sell your house, you'd sell your family, you'd quit your job, you'd hock all the jewelry, and you'd go to Seattle. There would be a sense of urgency that would overcome every other thing in your life. You would go through that 12-stage process because it's about survival. Well, we've got an illness that's worse than pancreas cancer. At least pancreas cancer allows you the dignity of putting your affairs in order before you check out. We check out in absolute, utter disgrace. Where the people that are close to us either pity us or hate us. It's a much worse illness. Okay, but here's what happens. Newcomer comes up to me. Oh, Chris, this is tough. You know, I got a summons in my pocket. I'm thrown out of the house. I lost my job. I'm drinking. Oh, it's just, you know, will you help me? Yeah, sure. You do understand that you've got a progressively fatal illness, that you're powerless over it. You've got an obsession in the mind that's going to bring you back to alcohol unless you have a spiritual awakening. You do understand that, right? Well, yeah. So you really need to get involved in consistent meetings. You need to work the steps, and then you need to be of service to other people. You understand that, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, come on over to my house on Tuesday night, and we'll start working through the book.
Oh, wow, man.
See, we lack that enthusiasm, that sense of urgency that you would get with any other illness, because alcoholism, inherent in alcoholism, is an utter inability to recognize how much trouble you're in. If you're new, just coming back, or haven't gone through the steps, and you're in this room tonight, there's two things I know. One is, you're in way more trouble than you think you are. Okay? Whatever trouble you think you are, multiply it by 10, and you're getting close. And the other thing is there's more fundamental answers in Alcoholics Anonymous than you're giving Alcoholics Anonymous credit for. There are things in your life that Alcoholics Anonymous can help you fix that you don't even see yet, because you're so sick you don't even know you're sick. You know what I mean? You're so ill you have no idea that you're ill. So hang out here and you know, go for the gold ring at the end of the steps, please. Another story that my friend Sandy B tells. I absolutely love this. Does anybody remember the Jack Benny Radio Hour? You got to be kind of old to remember the Jack Benny Radio Hour, okay? But anyway, Jack Benny was famous for being the cheapest person on earth. He saved every single penny he ever made. He never parted with a nickel, okay? So you're listening on the radio and you hear Jack Benny walking down the sidewalk and somebody runs up behind him and it's obviously a robber because they go, "Your money, hold him up, your money or your life." And all of a sudden you kind of hear silence. And pretty soon, you know, the studio audience gets it, and they start laughing a little. And finally, the robber goes, "Well?" And Jack Benny goes, I'm thinking. Now, that's what happens with us, with the newcomers. You know, you're going to die an absolute horrible death. We've got a solution here with which we all can agree. We found a way out. You know, you need to participate in spiritual living. Alcoholism is your problem. Spiritual living is your solution. Let's get started. And there's silence. And you go, "Well, I'm thinking. You know, die an alcoholic death, live life along spiritual lines. I'm thinking." It's just, it's crazy. Now, somewhere along the line, this big book thing that I was doing in my house started to grow. It started with my sponsees, and then it became my sponsees were saying, "Hey, can I bring Joe over?" You know, "Yeah, sure, bring Joe over." And it started to become a meeting in my house. And a really strange thing happened. This happened around 1997. Somebody had sent me one of their sponsees who was drinking on them. And I took this guy through the steps. He had like 93 amends. He did like 92 of them and couldn't find the last person. I mean, this guy went out and did some heroic step work. Heroic step work. And you do that kind of stuff, and man, you are reborn. You know, the lights are on, and you are on fire, and God is like speaking out of your mouth. And this guy was just on fire. And the guy who sent him to me said, "What the hell did you do to so-and-so? You know, could you do that to me?" And he came over, and he had like 12 or 13 years. He started to go through the steps. He had that momentous spiritual change that you get when you practice the 12 steps. It's a fundamental transformational spiritual process. And he was friends with a priest. And the priest was watching what was going on. He's going, "What the hell is happening to you?" And he told him, "Well, there's this guy, Chris, that's taking people through the steps over to his house." He goes, "Where can I find this guy?" So what happened was I was speaking at NetCong, and the priest tracked me down there, listened to me speak, and then came up after the meeting and said, "Whatever you're doing at your house, in your room, I want you to do it at my church. I'll give you any room. You don't have to pay any rent if you can't afford it. Any night of the week, I want it to be part of my church's mission. I think what you're doing is important." Now, you have to understand, I was still very, very much attached to how people thought about me at this period of time. Now, I had a lot of friends in AA. And as long as I was keeping this at my house, you know, it was kind of safe. But what this guy was asking me to do was start a meeting in a church where I would teach and show people how to take the spiritual exercises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew that was not really a good thing for me to do. Because there was step meetings, there was closed-minded discussion meetings, and there And there was speaker meetings. That's all there was. Okay, there was no Chris teaches out of the big book like a big shot know-it-all meetings. You know, But I knew I had to do this. I mean, this priest found me, you know, and I'm watching all these transformations happening. There's like, you know, some real things going on here. So I did. I got some of my friends together, and we started the Spiritual Awakenings Group in December 1997. And I immediately lost 80% of my friends. I was very popular in AA, but as soon as I did that, I immediately lost 80% of my friends. You know, when you take a stand sometimes for something you truly believe in, and I had to for this, because of my own personal experience and my experience working with others, you can cut a room in half. And I did more than that. And, you know, some of these people just kind of say hi to me and kind of tolerate me, who were very, very close to me before. But let me tell you the good news. The good news is that it's possible. One of the promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is that you can develop the fellowship you crave. You can build the fellowship you crave. What's going on in this room, what I've seen the three times I've come here, is a marvelous fellowship that's not forgetting the recovery program is being developed in this room. And there's going to be wholesale miracles happening in this room. And to be a part of that is really, really an extraordinary experience. To be able to see people when the lights go on, you know, when they've had that spiritual awakening, when they've had that spiritual experience, you know, when the promises start to come true for them. And that's what I've been able to experience in Burnsville. You know, some of the things that happened in my life. When I first got sober, I was a really bad electrician. I don't know how I became an electrician. It's a bad trade to be when you're a blackout drinker, okay? I blew so much stuff up, you know what I mean? I remember hooking this guy's well pump. It was a 110 well pump. I hooked it up to 220. He goes, man, the water pressure's kicking today. You know? A day later, they're pulling this meteorite, you know, out of the ground. You know, another time I drilled in the wrong spot and, you know, pulled a guy's suit coat up into the attic with me. You know, he opens, you know, all his suits are covered with plaster and one of them curled up into the hole. I mean, you know, just time after time after time, I was blowing stuff up. And I was bad, too. I mean, I was 33 years old. The guy who was in charge of me was 18. Okay, he was in charge of me. You know, take care of Chris today. You know, the boss had said, try to keep him away from anything, you know. Have him work out in the garage or something. And I mean, I was really near unemployable, you know, shaken and yellow and, you know, high strung and with the sensitive alcoholic feelings. You know, what'd you say? You know, I mean, I was just a nut. And I finally get sober and then I find recovery. If you're lucky, you'll find recovery in the fellowship. You know, one of the things that drives me crazy is when people share, you know, when I came into the program, you don't come in to the program. You come into the fellowship. The program are the steps in the book. You can say when I took the steps of the program, but you don't say when I came into the program. Words matter sometimes, okay? You don't want to give people the wrong idea. You do not want someone to think that going to meetings is working a program. It's not. If you sit in a chicken coop for 2 or 3 years, is it going to make you a chicken? You know what I mean? If you want to be a recovered alcoholic, you have to practice recovery principles. You know, so anyway, you know, here I am. I'm starting to not shoot myself in the foot as much. I'm starting to do things like this, which was a revelation to me. I would tell you what I was going to do, and then I would do what I told you I was going to do. Whoa! Zen moment, you know, because that never would occur to me, you know, when I was drinking. And so when you start to do that, you start to become reliable, dependable, and trustworthy. You know, and because I wasn't, you know, shattered every morning, I started to be able to think and do my job better. And I worked from a bad electrician up to, in 2007, I was in charge of 80 New York City schools. You want to talk about a serious, heavy-duty, nerve-wracking job. Try working for 35 people that work for the DOE. You know what I mean? You will not find larger egos. on this planet. And, you know, two phones are going, and, you know, it's the boilers are exploding, and, you know, I got crews here, and I got contractors there, and the elevator's down, there's people, you know, just, it was insane. It was like a 12-hour-a-day insane job. But I went from not being able to deal with, you know, wiring an outlet to being in charge of 80 New York City schools. And it wasn't that I went after that. You know, nobody in their right mind would want to do that. But what I did was I just became more and more effective, and I kept getting promoted. Now, turn my will and my life over to the care of a higher power. All right. A lot of these steps, a lot of these spiritual exercises are like the peeling of an onion. We can take them and we can get what we get the first time we do it. But like any truly, truly masterful classic spiritual text, it will meet you where you are. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're a newcomer, it will meet you as a newcomer. However, if you have 20 years and you're looking for a deeper experience, it will meet you there. And I got to a point at the end of 2007 where I was kind of thinking that maybe God didn't want me putting out all these fires, and maybe there's something better for me to do. And I got offered the opportunity to become part of a startup. Now, this was really risky because I went from Manhattan money to like 6 months living on savings while I get this startup going, and if it doesn't get going, I'm totally hosed. But I just was at that point where I could say, you know, God, I'm doing this because it's going to help more of your children. You got to take care of the money because, you know, I can't handle that too. I'll do this job the best I can do. You know, you help me with strength and direction. But I'm taking this leap, and you got to have my back. And I was at a point where I could do that. I don't think I could have gotten to that point before then. But what's happened is I've become part of some really amazing things. I'm a media director for a recovery organization now that's funded by a large foundation. I'm the host of webcasts with addiction professionals. I actually go around the country and around the world sometimes interviewing the best of the best, the people who are in charge of treating us, the clinicians, the scientists. You know, those type of people, I'm actually interviewing them and looking for people who have best practices, you know, the people who are on cutting edge. So I'm learning a lot there. And I got an opportunity to be put on two boards. Now, I'm a board member of the NCADD. I'm a board member of C4 Recovery Solution. The only reason I'm saying this is because you wouldn't have put me in charge of a lemonade stand in 1989. You know what I mean? And every single thing that's happened in my life, I take no personal credit for it. If I've done anything, it's been willingness born of desperation, not virtue. I don't want to go back to the way it was. I will participate in spiritual living a day at a time, just to avoid going anywhere near the way I felt years ago. I don't want to experience any of that anymore. And along the way, I'm having an absolute blast. There's just some things that are going on in my life today that are extraordinary. You know, I got to say this. I am absolutely overpaid in every single way today, except financially. And you know what? I can live with that. Listen, thanks for having me here tonight. It's been a blast.